Yes, I'll read this conclusion once more. Styling clay models are being used to a greater extent today than ever before. Although many voices have been raised advocating the demise of models and replacing them with CAD-CAM systems, it is essential that, at some point in the design program, a three-dimensional model be developed. Today, styling clay models meet the high-tech requirements of the industry better than any other model construction material. Just to conclude this, with the systems that have been developed and are being utilized at Ford, you've got this capability of stable modeling frames and armatures. So your clay model is not going to change. You have an exact method of positioning this model and repositioning it, always. And through the modular construction of utilizing this equipment for many programs, for many years, and with the use of the coordinate measuring and scanning milling systems, which Ford has and many other companies have this capability, the clay meets all of these high-tech requirements. You have, in addition to that, this ability for unlimited freedom of expression. You can add on an inch or take off 2 inches. You can add on 5/1000ths, which you do sometimes, or a 1/16th of an inch, just to fill out a form or to work out a highlight. And you can see these highlights, or you can mark the highlight on the model. Now, you can mark a highlight with a computer, too. You can mark that on a CAD-CAM system. But one of the things which perhaps can be developed in a computer, which I have not seen developed and used, but one of the things that I use all the time in developing a three-dimensional model, and which is used by anyone, whether they realize it or not, and that is reading your lines and highlights in comparison with your silhouettes. You look at a silhouette, and as you travel around a model or change your viewpoint up and down, you can read the lines and highlights and forms, and basically the silhouette is the form. You read those with the highlights and the lines, and this is something I have not seen done yet in computer graphics. Now, it may be that they will develop this with solid modeling, for instance. It may be that they will be able to develop this to an extent that you can utilize it. But again, one of the differences, one of the basic differences, and one of the things that I have found to be true in most instances is that in computer graphics, you're developing on a small tube, and you're blowing this up full size. And normally, when you blow up from a small sketch to a full-size model, and I'm talking about an accurate layout to a full-size model, the forms look heavy and awkward, and you want to change these forms. The forms do not lend themselves to a full-size development. So going strictly from a graphics tube small scale to a full-size model, your form is going to look heavy and fat, or maybe the opposite. Maybe you've designed it so it's too shrill, or too, as E.T. Gregory used to say, too bony. You, at that point of time, you want to get in there and start enhancing the design by modifying the form, either by taking something off or adding something on here and there. And this is why the clay is such a useful form, because you can just put on as thin a layer as necessary and peel off as thin a layer as necessary, or change it by inches if required.
Do you envision any sort of robotic application of the clay
Well, this system that I mentioned that Lamerson had come up with
could be. Could that be refined in the next 50 years? Approaching the feasibility?
A lot of the work that I did in developing equipment really accomplished a reduction in manpower, but I was not trying to utilize systems to replace skills.
No.
The skill of the artisan. I was trying to get rid of the menial tasks.
Right.
And get rid of the inaccuracies that existed. And that's what Ford has now. But to utilize a machine in place of a person's skill, I feel is very unjustified and not necessary. It's foolish trying to make a machine to do, and very difficult, by the way, trying to make a machine do what a person can do. A person utilizing his skills has a combination of mind, eye, sensitivity, hands, muscles, nerves. You try to put all of this into a machine. Perhaps you have seen on television here recently one of the science programs. They have developed a hand that will function, but the cost of developing that hand is enormous, and doesn't you know, why develop a hand when you can have a person that has a hand?
This is obviously one discipline that cannot be completely duplicated by machine.
It's very difficult.
Yeah.
Very difficult. Then what you have is a man standing back here making this machine work. So why not have the man out there doing it?
Right. And getting much, much more sensitive calculations and results.
I remember a program I heard on the radio, and it was radio, and this was back in sometime in the 1940s when they were first talking about robots. This program was about a very advanced future period of time, and there had been a war where man had been exterminated and the human society was gone. All that was left was robots. And there was a male and female robot that started a new human development, a new human line. They had been developed to that point, and they took over. Not because they didn't destroy mankind. Mankind had destroyed themselves, which is always a theme, you know, which I don't believe in. But anyway, this was interesting. Robots in the future could be developed, I suppose, to do these things, but
as a convenience.
There are so many things where environmental conditions do not warrant the human body to be in that particular place, and these are the places that a robot should be used, where you've got toxic materials and so forth.
Certainly. Under the ground mining might be an interesting.
Yes, right.
Where it is really awkward for humans to.
Yes.
Exist.
Yeah, they have developed some very sophisticated for that the machine equipment and machines for that, so they could go a lot further. Yeah.
Well, do you have any in the abstract? Put your philosophy into the abstract. I know you work with concrete forms, finite forms, but can the art of modeling be described as from a philosophical approach, your own perhaps?
well, it's of course really design.
Right.
That's
sometimes that's lost in the show.
There have been certain designs, I'm talking about automobiles principally, although other things too, which is the product of an individual. And this has been of course, basically under the very strict control of an individual, because it's one person really cannot design a complete car. He can very closely control it. Architecture, Frank Lloyd Wright, I suppose, certain others, Dow. It's a philosophy, and the students mold into that philosophy, and they express that designer's will, you might say. And the automobile, this has happened a few times. However, the really outstanding automobile designs principally have come from a nucleus of somebody's idea and a certain period of time when everything keyed together and you had the backing or the overall philosophy coming from maybe someone in management that says we need to do so and so, and it needs to have this sort of a size, and it needs to accomplish this sort of a purpose, and it should look so and so, very sleek and low and whatever. And I'm thinking now of a certain few automobiles, for instance, the 810 Cord, the 36 Cord. Gordon Burek has always been given the credit for this, but it was management decision, and principally A.L. Card himself that set the pattern for this. The design of this front end theme was one that Gordon Burek brought in, and something that he had worked on, I understand, at GM.
The coffin nose.
However, that theme you'll also find in a car that was developed in Germany in the Bauhaus in maybe 1928, something like that.
Earlier in the rudimentary form in the Doble steam.
Yeah, it picked it up a little bit. So the theme had been started. Burek brought it to Auburn Car Duesenberg. And they had developed a baby Duesenberg, which was developed baby Duesenberg.
Yeah, right.
And there are patent drawings of that, just as there are patent drawings of the Cord. So you can see the similarities. At least the theme was there. Management decided no, they wanted a front drive, and I think this was Cord himself that he wanted his name on it, and he saw this as opportunity to come out with a newer Cord that would have this theme. So he said, no, it needs to be front wheel drive, and we need to reduce the height and go further, make it, you know, more extreme. Well, there was another designer there. I should have my sources here. Sometimes these names escape me. Anyway,
Ed Cord,
a young fellow. And that Cord was as much his design, the rest of it, as it was Burek's. It was developed in a 3/8 model, or pardon me, in a 1/8 scale model. And they had a bridge on a board. So that theme of developing a car design was already there. So therefore, it became a team that worked together. It was not just Burek, and it was not just this other fellow, and I'm sorry I don't have the name in front of me. And it was the other fellows in there, and their critique of this as it developed. And they didn't go to a full-size clay. They went to a full-size prototype of some type, and it clicked, and the design was there. But it was a team of people that did this, and this has happened many times in the development of outstanding designs. It's a team effort, and certainly not a committee effort. Committee effort will tend to take away. A team effort will build. But you have to have somebody in management that is sensitive to these things. You have to have a design control, in the case of the 810 card Burig, that recognizes people and skills and a design theme and puts it into action. And you've got to have a team in design working together and engineering that will work with this team. We saw this happen in Germany, both in development of the first Taunus that we did there, and also in this car, both of which had a considerable influence on European automobile design, this scale model. That's also a Taunus.
A later development. Yeah.
But we had unique...
What did that come out as in Germany?
It came out, that particular one came out, I think, in 1964.
Did it have a designation?
It was called the Taunus 17 and 20M.
That existed for a number of years, didn't it?
Well, it had a facelift in 67 or 68. As a 68 model. So it ran 4 years,
yeah,
and was very very high in sales, built sales. The one that came out afterwards, as I had mentioned in my notes here, was not nearly as successful because it did everything that was wrong. It did not have a leader at the time. John Andrews had left and been called into a higher position. The person that took over did not have sensitivity to design. An engineering head came in that was controlling it, and everything was related to cost. And design was secondary. Manufacturing became very strong, and they wouldn't accept and do certain things. As the car was initially shown and approved in clay, it might have been much more successful.
I have a feeling from what you're saying that the tradition of the craftsman, modeler, fabricator is much stronger and much more revered in Europe than it is in this country, in the automobile industry. That in those countries, the tradition of a guild craftsman is a much more honored.
Yes, I suppose because of their schooling and training methods. The people that we hired had all gone through some sort of, virtually all, gone through some sort of apprenticeship program, or had been a graduate from an art school or a ceramic school. We had many modelers that had graduated from a ceramic school, and they would have gone into the ceramic industry, except that we had advertised for people in those areas and in those schools.
It would have been a natural progression.
It was a natural progression. They had done design themselves in the ceramic school and done drawing, so they knew all the essentials of design. They came into modeling, and all they had to learn really was how to develop these full-size models. They had been used to developing small things, and so we had some excellent people.
Many of them as you mentioned earlier, did sculpting on the side as a avocation.
Yes, many of them did these sorts of things, other things, you know. They
carving.
Kept active in their schooling traits, their interests.
In other words, working with one's hands is a venerable, obviously probably one of the earliest avocations of mankind, and it has evolved, as you mentioned, into a very sophisticated, very sensitive, very detailed kind of product. I honestly can't see how that could be replaced by even the most sophisticated equipment.
You would have to utilize people of these traits and sensitivities and talents and skills somehow you would still have to utilize these people, perhaps to a greater extent with computer-aided equipment. The things that I am proposing to do with scanning and milling equipment, again, is not going to replace the modeler. It's going to aid him. It's right. going to speed up his ability. Instead of sending in templates, he's going to be able to, right on the job, have a machine that will cut that, in effect, that template in, that line.
So that he can... As soon as the scanner indicates it's needed.
Well, this is what you start with, really. You start with a package drawing and master sections. And somebody has made this for you, an engineer.
Yeah.
And so that information is all ready developed. Well, what happens now, normally, if you don't have this equipment? You receive a drawing that has this master section, and either you make the template or you get the shop to make a template. Uh-huh. And you take that template, and it has vertical and horizontal lines. You attach that to a Norton angle plate, and you set this into hot clay. Mm-hmm. And you have developed a section.
Right.
And you develop a few of these in these critical areas. And you've got a sketch here, so you develop in three dimensions this sketch that will not interfere with these master sections, or not interfere with them substantially. Or if you find you can't develop it, then you go back to the engineer and say, hey, we need to make a change, or you don't, maybe the designer does, or the designer will change his theme. So the two things work together. So the engineer is always following these things, and the designer is always following this three-dimensional clay model. And the modeler is putting these ideas together all the time and further developing and refining the model.
You mentioned earlier that the different uses of more or less malleable material, clay being best, styrofoam in certain forms that
yes.
can be helpful.
Right.
You mentioned also the new fairly new technique of an impregnated wood. What gives you the best surface to develop all those, or are they interchangeable?
Well, they're interchangeable to some degree. If you have a fixed design, you know what that design is, which is what impreg is used for, impregnated mahogany.
Fixed in the sense that it's immutable at that point.
Well, you've got data
yeah.
and or drawings, and you make a hard model.
Mm-hmm.
And that hard model, therefore, is then used as your master to
right.
make tooling.
Right.
So that's what the impreg model is made from. And what Fisher Body uses these for, impreg models, they make the basic form upon which they can attach clay models of a particular part of a vehicle,
mm-hmm.
a detailed part
yeah.
or an inner panel that intersects with a door opening and has some sort of a molding there and a control lever and an escutcheon and all of these things. So they use the impreg to get themselves a very exact basic surface to work from.
With no danger of being tampered.
Yeah, that's not going to change.
Right.
You can use foam. You can make models from foam. Again, if you know what the form is, this system has been developed to some extent and has been used by Chrysler to some extent. A system was developed where you sculpt the whole car out of foam,
yeah.
and then you apply a hardening surface over that, and you can sand that down and paint it, and you've got a hard model. But it's very difficult to go back in and change that.
Yeah.
You've got to really rework that surface.
Clay is the only malleable material.
Yes, and it is possible to finish clay in a hard material. The RV industry has been using Bondo
oh, okay.
material, which every body shop uses, you know.
Sure.
And it's a very hard material, and they can build master models from this, from which they can cast their tooling. But it is also possible to make a finished clay model and prepare that clay model so that you have a hard surface and a so-called gel coat surface. Gel coat is the surface that you finish over Bondo is a polyester material from which you can make tooling. And I've got models standing there that I can show you. I'll show you. This is part of this presentation for Chavant Incorporated, the clay company.
What about fiberglass? Where does that fit in?
Well, normally, when you have a finished model, you'll take a mold of this, and it could be a plaster mold, can be a fiberglass mold, it can be a combination. Lots of times they'll take a what they call a rubber mold, a silicon mold, which will pull off of a very complex form without having piece molds, and you cast a backup part for that to hold the rubber in its shape. You take the back off, cast off, you can stretch this rubber around and pull it off, set it into this backup cast, and it comes back to its original form. And you can cast in fiberglass then, you can reproduce a positive form out of the negative that you've taken off the clay. Therefore, you can make a hard model which then can be painted and sent to out to market research, or make a prototype, or at least make a visual model, or make production parts. Most of the RVs are fiberglass.
What mode do you prefer to work with your long career?
Well, since going into the RV industry and learning really their processes, which are quite different, since they want to make a model that they can cast from and have a master negative, in effect. And you can make parts from that, but normally what they do, they'll make a prototype and maybe work out some of their problems, and then they will make a hard master off of that negative that came from their original model. This you can do in clay, or if you make it out of Bondo, you will make the changes, you'll go back and make your changes on that original hard model from then, which you will cast your tooling. But I've developed this process where you can finalize a clay model and finish it so it is a hard surface from which you then can make hard negatives and or hard tooling. So it's really a new use for modeling clay in the RV industry.
The negative is sort of like a matrix?
It's a cast off the clay.
Yeah.
But you usually don't use that original model. You will usually cast a negative and then cast a master, even in the RV industry.
This is the whole vehicle or section of
it? Well, it probably would be a section. If it's a motorhome, it's like the front cap,
the
rear cap. If it's a pickup cap, then it's the whole unit.
Then you would have to, they would have to be bonded together. Wanted a full-size model.
Yes.
Yeah.
And normally they rivet these things together or screw them together, and then they'll have some sort of a covering to cover their rivets. Although there are efforts being made to develop more uniquely these methods of bringing panels together, so that you have a more of a sophisticated method of tying them together. This one designer I work with, Dennis Otto, he calls these coverings the ugly strips.
Ugly strips?
So he's and I, we've been working on systems to get rid of the ugly strips, attach these panels more uniquely so that you have a more flush surface without.
Oh, you mean to get rid of the seam?
Get rid of the seams.
Okay,
Seams that are either the attachment itself or the strip that you put on to cover the attachment.
Mm-hmm. I see. What normally would that,
Well, they're vinyl
okay.
Coverings, and sometimes those have a bright, bright vinyl insert, or color strip or whatever, and It merely breaks up the design. So that's why he calls them the ugly strips.
Are these model prototypes, are they drivable?
In the case of the RV industry, yes. I think I, well, the first pictures that I have shown you in many of those slide presentation developments were prototypes. Mm-hmm. Not all of them, but some of them were. And they came out of the negatives taken off the clay. And in those cases, the prototype parts were primed and surfaced and then painted. This, of course, doesn't happen normally in the RV industry. In the RV industry, they try to, not always, but they try to have a finished mold so they can cast a part out with finished surface coats. Okay, following the completion of the Excalibur, Georgie Boy, which was a job that had been found by, I had a sales rep, and he had been working at Coachman when I was there. So he found Georgie Boy for me, and he himself had been out looking various places for possible jobs that we could do, and he was also instrumental in finding Lear. And so we had L-E-E-R, the pickup cab company. As you see on the back of pickup caps, a lot of them, it says Lear, King of Caps.
And they convert the pickup into a camper, really?
Well, more or less, although these are not campers as such. They're strictly covers. But every pickup is a potential customer for a cap, except for those that put on sliding campers. And those who don't put on anything. Trucks, pickup trucks, have become a tremendous business. In fact, pickup trucks are the largest single sales of vehicles in the last 2-3 years. The vehicle selling the most numbers of units are now pickups. So anyway,
obviously a great potential market for aftermarket.
All sorts of things, yes. Anything that you put on a pickup cap or in them, they are equipped. So many women will drive them these days, and they're equipped, you know, like our Bronco. It's got air conditioning, and it's carpeted, and it's all deluxe, and
stereo system.
Yeah, they can become a beautiful car for traveling in, because you've got space, load things in them, and they're comfortable.
They don't ride like a truck anymore.
They're more like a super passenger car. So anyway, John Collins, the head of Lear,
where are they based?
In Elkhart.
Okay.
He had had a plant across the way from where the this minivan of Coachman had been built, and every day he would see these minivans coming out, and he thought, gee, that's a nice looking unit. I wish I would have that sort of design on my pickup caps. And so when Joe Namony, who is the sales rep for me, had visited him and told him, Namey, I believe, had told him that we had done the development work on Coachman for this minivan. Well, he was quite excited, so we did the initial development on the Chevrolet S10 pickup. And so when it came out, when he was able to acquire one, why, we started that development.
Excuse me, I think I've seen Lear caps for the last 10 years.
Yes.
Or even earlier. What was that?
Approximately that length of time, yes. It's a relatively new company. It's a very interesting story, and I don't know whether I've got time to go into this.
Okay.
But let me sort of hit the high spots, because it's quite unusual. It's sort of the thing that happens, still happens, down at Elkhart. It's maybe more difficult here in the automobile industry, but down there it has always been sort of a cottage industry, and then some of them become sort of super cottage.
Mm-hmm.
But it still has some of that type of homey atmosphere. He had graduated from college, and he had moved to Elkhart, I think.
Mr. Lear.
Yeah, Mr. Lear, John Collins.
Oh, Collins, I'm sorry.
Lear, it was a time when Lear aircraft was quite prominent in the news, and he liked the name, but he thought, well, I'll tie it in with King Lear of
Shakespeare. Yeah. Oh, this is Collins.
John Collins. Okay. And I'll call it King. King of Caps. Lear, King of Caps.
Right, sure.
So this is how it acquired its name.
However, he couldn't use the original spelling because that
Yeah, I'm not sure.
He had to use a double E.
And King Lear was L-E-A-R. That could be the reason as it's changed.
I think he may, Lear aircraft had a copy.
Yes, that's right. He couldn't use the spelling of Lear aircraft. That's correct. So that's why the spelling is different. But he applied Shakespeare rather than the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
But so he came to Elkhart. He had gotten married, and his wife came from Elkhart, and he was working in a RV supply house there. And people would come in and they'd ask, where can I buy a pickup cap? He said he didn't know what a pickup cap was. And he soon found that they made them across the street from where this supply company was. So he went over and looked at the plan and looked at what they were doing. And he decided, shoot, I can make those. So he borrowed, or was given, I don't know which, $2,500 from his father-in-law and his father-in-law's garage. And he started to build pickup caps. Well, he soon moved out of the garage into this plant that was by where Coachman built their minivan. And he built this up. And sales went along quite well because it was a growing business. And however, he got into drinking and using drugs, and he was a very astute businessman, and of course this sidetracked everything, and eventually he was in a one-car accident. He wrapped himself into a tree. Unfortunately, it was the passenger car that hit the passenger side of the car that hit the tree, and it broke his neck. And his doctor told him that most people who have their neck broken never live, and those who do survive are not able to have all their body functions again, their arms and legs and so forth. And he survived and had all of his control over his body. And he joined the AA and became quite active in this organization and working with young people and others who had alcohol and drug-related problems. And by this time, his company was in dire financial straits, and the banks were going to foreclose, and he owed $500,000. And he was in a neck brace, and he went to the bank and to meet with them, and they were telling him they were preparing to foreclose. He says, well, if you foreclose, you're not going to get your money back because there's hardly anything there. He says, give me another chance, and I've mended my ways, and I believe that I can pay this off. So they gave him another chance. And, well, the other thing, and the thing that is tied in with the AA that he was associated with is, it really is a based on Christian ideals and Christian principles, and he became a Christian. And inside of 2 years, which is when I first came to him, he had moved into this other plant where I first met him, which was twice as large. He had paid off his $500,000 debt. During the time that I was associated with him, he doubled the size of that plant, built another plant down the street a little ways for all of his aluminum caps, which again doubled the size of it. He built a plant in Atlanta, Georgia, which was again like another double of his original plant. Anyway,
he also established a chain of small franchises, distributorships.
Yes, he established distributors. He's since established a partnership. These plants that he has, the one in Atlanta, for instance, is his brother-in-law, or his first wife divorced him through all of this. So anyway,
he kept in touch with his brother-in-law.
Yes, he had established this with his brother-in-law, I think, before that happened, probably. And he established a partnership on the West Coast with a company that built caps. And so he's got a partnership there. He also has established a new plant in Pennsylvania with partners there that built windows. And of course, windows are one of the main items that go into caps, so you have to have them. So he has that plant now also. Every year he takes his 10 top distributors, sales from around the country, and takes them on a special trip someplace, and gives them an award and so forth. So he's very aware of marketing and marketing principles, and but he's very fair, and but he's very strict also. He knows everything that goes on, and he recognizes design, and he recognizes has taste, and so many of these people don't. You know, they build anything and put it on the road, and he's very concerned about finish and fit and appearance. So it's a rather unusual story.
And he's obviously sold an enormous amount of money.
Become a millionaire, you know. In the midst of all this, he had gotten remarried, and the lady he married had two children. I think her husband had died, and he had two children. And in the meantime, now they have had a child, and so his house became too small. So he's built a new house, and you know, it's all going that way. But he's a hard man. He's
a
hard worker.
What was your connection with him?
Well, I was his designer.
Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I went in, and he wanted to work directly with me, and really didn't want to have his people involved except technically as necessary. In fact, we even did this first design in another building. He rented some space in another building there, which he has since acquired. But so, as in the slide presentation, I had this friend of mine, Dennis Otto, who was free at the time, make several sketches, and he bought one of those sketches. I had another designer also working on it, and we built this blackboard affair that we put into right into the pickup cap and put tracing paper on that, and in a few minutes we were able to put some hard points, some package points onto that, and with black tape represent the side elevation of a pickup cab, so you could stand back and you could see this design. So we went through three or four different designs in one afternoon and settled on a design, and I took those lines and made a three-view layout and made a drawing so that they could make up the armature, which they did. They used aluminum tubing and made this armature for me, and we put plywood on that and shellacked it and put the clay right over that, so there was only a from a half inch to an inch of clay on it. And it was quite stable. It was mounted right on the pickup. The pickup was leveled and weighted down with boxes of clay and supported, so it was, you know, didn't move. So we worked right off the top edge of the pickup box.
Flare of the bed.
Whatever shape that had, that's what we built into it.
You say it's a slide now?
Not really. They clamp down.
They clamp.
Well, then we did some various other things.
I can see with the flare side, you could slide it down.
Well, of course, basically, what they call the slide-on camper really does that. And they normally, although not all of them, they normally extend out over the back of the pickup. So
first
you've got to step in.
With the bed.
A pickup cap normally just sets above the box and attaches down to the edge of the box. And normally has a just a lift gate, so you've got your tailgate and a lift gate on the pickup box. So it comes complete and sets down and seals against the top edge of the box and the tailgate. Well, it can be built very inexpensively. It's all one unit. You buy that unit and set it on and clamp it down and away you go. And you take it off and stand it here in the yard if you want to carry something that is taller than what the camp is. But we did several other jobs. We did a job with a company called Bivouac. We made a like a cab extension.
How do you spell it?
Bivouac.
B-I-V-O-A-C.
You know, you caught me with that.
Well, that's okay. I think it's B-I-V-A-O-C.
I think it is. B-I-V.
O-A-C. O-A-C.
Bivouac. O-A-C.
Yeah, right.
It's what the Army does.
That's right. Who thought up that name?
I don't know. They're in Michigan, a little town just north of Elkhart. But Lear, we did the design at Lear, and Lear made the parts for this. And it was quite unique. I should have my book here so I can show you these things. Why don't you turn that on?
Back to Bivouac.
Back to Bivouac. B-I-V-O-U-A-C.
U-A-C.
U-A-C.
Okay. That's a variant spelling.
It might be. They may do this to avoid problems, as you had mentioned.
Perhaps. Well, if you could describe this in audio.
Well, in effect, it's sort of a cab extension, and with the sliding glass in the back of the cab, you could reach through. This would seal against the cab. You could reach through, and there was a shelf here, so you could put things in there.
Uh-huh.
And of course, it was open below.
From the cab?
In the shelf, yes.
Right, yeah. That, in
and
fact,
then
would be it, the greenhouse.
It hinged here, so it was really a box cover and not a cap as you normally see them. So you could...
It couldn't be used as a camper, per se.
No, but you could carry things in it and keep it covered. The next major thing we did was this Rockwood front and rear cap, which was a very dramatic design. And we did some very unusual features. And one of the features of this was that it has a 55-degree angled sloped windshield, V windshield, and is quite...
This is a motorhome, right?
A motorhome.
It looks like the Aerostar swiped that from you. The new Ford Aerostar.
Yeah, it has quite an angle, doesn't it?
Yeah, right, yeah.
For a motorhome, it's quite extreme. But we utilized our...
You're talking about the design or the interior? Or the
well, the angle of the windshield.
Oh, okay. Fine.
And this, of course, and it has fairly soft corners to improve the aerodynamics.
What year was this?
I think this was 80... Must have been 83.
So you preceded both the Ford and the Chevrolet vans, and maybe even the Chrysler.
I don't know that there was any influence.
Yeah, right. you probably know as well as other designers that these things sort of are in the air.
Sure.
Everybody.
Well, Coachman had, and while the designer from this was Dennis Otto, the engineer was Vern Walmsley, and Vern Walmsley was vice president of engineering at Coachman. And they had done some aerodynamic studies, and they found that an angled windshield on this box was a big aid to reducing drag. So that basically is the reason for this steep angle of the windshield.
Walmsley,
Walmsley. We utilized master three-dimensional engineering and master modeling on the front end of this, on the hood.
And which one is this again?
On the Rockwood.
The Rockwood.
On the hood and on a lower section here at the bottom of the skirt, where we could model the surface and then cast those areas that were removable, and then complete the work and cast the whole front end without actually disturbing the surface itself. So you still had the major surface. We also, an unusual thing, we did the grill as a separate model, but we finished the grill inside of the whole front end cap model, and then removed it and finished it for casting separately, and finished the front end of the cap, the area, the surface below the grill, so that the whole front end cap could be cast without the grill.
Was this an economy that move? Or?
Well, it's it makes sure that everything fits, because it all comes from one unit.
Who was Rockwood and where were they based? Or where
they were based near Elkhart, in a small town near Elkhart.
Seems to be a center for RV and motorhomes.
I think the major RV industry is in that area.
Winnebago out there?
No, Winnebago is in Iowa.
That's what I thought.
And
yeah.
There are a few in California. There's a few
exceptions.
In Florida and elsewhere, but
Elkhart,
the bulk of
them
seem to be in Elkhart. The rear cap was done in a similar fashion, except we had no removable parts in that case.
Right.
We had working on that this fellow, John Bird, who had been director of modeling at GM Design, and we had this fellow, Kenny Gillette, who was the head modeler in the Cadillac studio.
They were moonlighting.
No, at that time they had retired.
Oh, they both retired.
They both retired.
This is the brochure, and it's called
brochure,
A Touch of Class, Sophisticated Styling, Comfort, and Personal Luxury Beyond Compare. What do these retail for? Do you have any idea?
Gee, I'm not sure.
Somewhere in the 20,000s.
I would say it might be closer to 60 or 70.
Okay, good. 60,000. Really quite luxurious and remarkable.
Yeah. Well, we did several developments.
And back to Coachman, I see. Yeah?
Yes, this was a fender for a trailer. And from a design to a layout to a model, which you could call a master model, to a polyurethane tooling plastic negative, to a polyurethane master positive. Out of that, both of the negative and the positive set up within a period of 20 to 30 minutes. And that was vented. In other words, holes were drilled through that for vacuum forming. And that was then mounted on a board and used in a vacuum form tool where heated ABS material was stretched down over it.
What's ABS?
It's a ABS is a plastic that is becomes very soft when heated. So they heat it up to about 350 degrees, something like this, and it becomes very pliable. And it's held on a frame. It's laid down over the form, which in this case is this positive cast. And the frame is pulled down around the perimeter of the base, and the model has holes drilled in it, and then you turn a valve that turns on a vacuum tank, and it sucks all the air out from between the material and the master, so that it takes that form and it quickly cools and retains that form. Anyway,
you say polyurethane?
A polyurethane negative and positive.
Oh, good.
And the interesting thing about this is you can go from a clay model to finished parts installed in a day. We also did a pickup cap louver window for Coachman on that particular thing. This shows how the minivan was constructed and the tooling for it. The tooling.
What was your part in that?
Well, I had charge of the whole thing.
The whole thing?
Yes.
Oh. Is that still being marketed?
No. No, not now. There's too many other minivans.
These are all in the last 5 years that you've been doing this since you retired.
Well, this. Yeah, this really was done in fall of 79, and early 80, the single flush mounted side door was done in early 80, and this was accomplished through master modeling, this three-dimensional master modeling system, and it was very unusual, very timely, very inexpensive, and it worked.
When you say master modeling system, is that a process?
It's a process.
Which cuts corners but comes up with a...
It's amazing. It can do...
quality product.
We had worked out the system at Ford on several studies. It was used on various things. It's not a patented or a classified system,
just
but...
just a generic way of...
Yes, you can say that. It's... a controlled way of developing master models from clay, and developing them through control of engineering, so that you're always up to date. And you cast these and use these as your masters, rather than making drawings and making masters from drawings or utilizing data. You end up with data and or masters made right off the clay. But this shows the one of the models with this side hinge door.
Fascinating.
And then we did several, well, this is a headliner for...
When you say we, you mean Holy Associates?
Yes.
And which consists of?
Well, we would use whoever was necessary for design or engineering or styling.
But is it basically you and your son?
Yes.
Which is, whose name is?
Timothy.
Timothy, yeah.
This is a headliner for a Chevrolet van for one of Coachman's divisions, Viking Form Products. And this, of course, is...
Was that for the Astro? Or was it a different type of van?
Yeah, it could be for the Astro.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah.
The Chevrolet Astro.
Yes, Chevrolet Astro. This was for development for a tractor roof for Case. And a very...
G.I. Case
in Racine, Wisconsin. It's a very complicated system.
Yeah.
And in this one, we utilize a three-dimensional engineering and master model concept. And the outer had...
Now, this is, if you describe this, what this is, what this does for the tractor operator.
Well, it, it provided, among other things, of necessity, a hatch in the roof. This was for European tractors.
Mm-hmm.
They require a hatch in the roof as an escape hatch.
Mm-hmm.
And so this shows the development, including that hatch and casting of that hatch.
Mm-hmm.
Although this roof had the requirements for U.S. also, so it had various lights in the front.
There are four lamps, aren't there?
Four lights in the front for illuminating and... two corner lamps.
Yeah.
And in the rear we had two red lamps.
Why is the front corner lamps red? Was that a...
Well, they're amber.
Oh, they're amber.
Yeah,
I see.
Amber.
And what did that signify?
Well, it's
fog, yeah.
It's like your corner lamps on
an
automobile. We also then utilize the negative from that to develop the interior of that same roof, which had several parts. It had the inner door hatch, it had the inner roof, it had a cover for all the auxiliary panels, the whatever controls they had that were in the roof, and it also had another part that that held some parts in place. I can't recall what that was, but very complicated, but it worked out quite well.
Yeah, Case was pleased.
Yes, however...
What was that last project you had?
Well, that was the display at a seminar we had at for the Fiberglass Fabrication Association in
Notre
Dame
a year ago. You and your son are bringing materials and slideshows and...
Yes, this is Paul O'Neill of Chabon Incorporated, and Tim was there and he put on the slide presentation for us.
And you're making a demonstration here at one point.
Yes, we had a working clay model.
What are you doing in this particular panel? You're demonstrating what?
Demonstrating, showing how you utilize clay in developing surface.
Yeah.
We also did a considerable amount of work for Case International. Case bought Tenneco, owned Case, bought International Harvesters agricultural division.
That's what I understand.
And so we did the development of an all-new tractor, completed that just a month before my accident.
Since your accident, you've been active, but not as certainly not as active as you had been previously.
I've been active on the telephone. I've talked with a lot of people.
You're doing consulting at long distance and by mail and by telephone.
Sitting on a seat.
Has it worked out pretty well?
Well, I think it's a good transition. I have since become 65, so I think it's time that I try another aspect of it again. Here is Roger Smith with his finger up telling people how to do it, but I don't think he knows.
I don't think he knows yet.
And of course, the same issue of automotive news is cover a story about Lacey's new Ford book, which I'm sure you have some opinions of.
No opinion. Also on Iacocca, who seems to be
Iacocca,
the coming Messiah.
Genesis of a giant.
Well, Mr. Holdy, it's been a delightful experience listening to your career reminiscence. You've had a magnificent career, and we thank you very much for sharing these with us.
Well, I've certainly enjoyed my career, and I've had a lot of things happen to me, and I guess I've been there ready to do most anything that was necessary in automotive design or industrial design, and with an interest in all of these things and all the aspects of design. And for that reason, I've had these opportunities, I think.
Well, thank you very much.